Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Granddaughter by Bernhard Schlink, translated by Charlotte Collins. This book was reviewed by Randy Boyagoda. When it comes to women revealing what they really think about their families after they die, it's hard to top Faulkner's Addie Bundren, reflecting from beyond the grave on the grudges and loathing she lived with as the unwilling matriarch of a dysfunctional Mississippi brood. A century later in Germany, the dead woman at the center of Bernhard Schlink's new novel, The Granddaughter, gives Addie a run for her money. Birgit grows up in East Germany after the war and dies in her 70s in unified Berlin. Her husband, a bookseller named Kaspar, finds her body drowned in the bathtub of their well-appointed apartment and can't tell if her overdose was accidental or intentional. Bereft, he receives a post-mortem query from a publisher about the manuscript Birgit was writing, which she never showed him. He finds and reads what seems to be an autobiography of Birgit's thoroughly embittered life, much of which she kept secret from him, from her young love affair with an older Communist Party officer that left her pregnant and alone, to her passionless marriage to Kaspar in Berlin, where she endured years of triumphalist condescension from West Germans. She writes regretfully and searingly about her hopes to someday meet the daughter she abandoned at birth. All that Kaspar knows for certain is that Birgit turned to alcohol and pills to numb her many pains. "I am not a monster," Birgit reflects defensively, regarding the freedom she felt in the moments after letting her newborn go. Instead of disagreeing, Kaspar finds a new purpose in his dead wife's failures and frustrations. He decides to find Birgit's daughter. This premise will feel familiar to readers of Schlink's previous novels, including his best-selling The Reader, which was adapted into an Oscar-winning film, many of which use individual relationships as proxies for examining the ongoing legacies of World War II and the Cold War in his native country. Schlink is not as elusive or cerebral a writer about modern Germany as W.G. Sebald, nor as intense or unflinching a storyteller as Jenny Erpenbeck. But he writes instructive tales that adeptly raise difficult questions and propose appealing answers. In The Granddaughter, translated into clear and accessible English by Charlotte Collins, these answers are found along Kaspar's journey into the former East Germany, where he eventually tracks down Birgit's daughter, Svenja, who was raised by her birth father and his wife and never knew about Birgit. In and out of reform school as a teenager, Svenja now leads a quiet rural life with her neo-Nazi husband and 14-year-old daughter, surrounded by fellow proponents of a purist Germany who reject national guilt over the Holocaust lie and commit themselves to defending the glory of the fatherland from foreign influence. Meeting them, Kaspar exhibits a measured, even respectful curiosity about their enthusiasm for ideas and attitudes that produced the most destructive period of modern world history. His fair-mindedness throughout the novel is so exemplary, it becomes wearisome. What follows is a rather schematic plot turn in which Kaspar persuades Svenja and her husband to let their daughter, Sigrun, whose heroes include Irma Greiss, an infamously brutal young guard in the women's section of Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen, visit him in Berlin every few months in exchange for payments from Birgit's estate. This they decide after Kaspar has met the couple only twice, a couple who are protective and generally distrusting and knew nothing about Birgit, let alone Kaspar, a week earlier. But the all-too-convenient arrangement allows Schlink to do what he really wants to do with this novel, stage an intergenerational encounter in contemporary Germany between a responsibly contrite, open-minded, aging post-war German and a rebellious, confidently nationalist post-unification teenager. And so Sigrun spends more than a year traveling between her home and Caspar's, where she has her own bedroom and piano lessons, where the two cook and travel and go to the Philharmonic and museums together, and where Caspar patiently tries to convince her of the authenticity of Anne Frank's diary. Unsurprisingly, this Pygmalion-style denazification project involves giving her books to inform and challenge her worldview, which inevitably leads to conflicts back home. After disappearing from his life without warning, Sigrun shows up again in Caspar's doorstep 2 years later, needing him to hide her from the police. At 18, she has inherited her mother's stubbornness, which ironically makes her rebel against Svenja's Völkisch politics and Third Reich nostalgia. She's eager to fight in the streets for her own vision for Germany, especially against her leftist peers, which Schlink shrewdly conveys as a kind of reactionary idealism to what she perceives as the political mushiness of her parents' generation. However disappointed and worried he becomes about Sigrun's situation, Caspar remains unconditionally supportive, losing his temper only once, on the perfectly calculated occasion of delivering an impassioned speech in defense of moderation to a Sigrun who proves, also conveniently, more and more open to her step-grandfather's perspective. And so this novel, finally too pleasing and affirming for readers who are rightly worried about political violence and radicalized youth, ends with a dignified old man envisioning a stable, cosmopolitan future for a wayward young girl. Some will read Schlink's latest as an aspiring fable of intergenerational unity and redemption. Others might find it more like a fantasy fiction. The reviewer, Randy Boyagoda, is a novelist and professor of English at the University of Toronto. Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age, by James Chappell. This book was reviewed by Dwight Garner. You see these gray hairs? Dorothy Parker asked in The New Yorker in 1928. Well, making whoopee with the intelligentsia was the way I earned them. Parker was 35 when she wrote that. Old age seemed to come on earlier back in the day. I'm thinking especially of poor Edward Casaubon, the scholarly suitor in Middlemarch. Edward is perceived to be dry and no better than a mummy at 45. I turn 60 this week. How old that seems will depend on how old you are. And like Aerosmith, I'm not ready for my Peace Out tour, nor am I yet studying the merits of competing brands of compression socks. I do plan, eventually, to use an ear trumpet rather than hearing inserts to better scare off children. I was born in 1965, narrowly missing the baby boom. I'm an elder of the Generation X tribe, two-thirds or so of the way around life's track. To get a better handle on where I and we are heading, I picked up James Chappell's new book, Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age. This is sober history, in the sense that it is no fun at all to read. Golden Years is related in baked potato, hold the butter and salt prose. While reading it, I felt my life slipping away more rapidly than usual. But Chappell, an associate professor of history at Duke, and a senior fellow at the Duke Aging Center, knows this material front to back, and he gets some important things said. His book is a tour of America's 20th century, in succeeding waves of oldies. He lingers especially on the passage of the Social Security Act, signed into law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1935. He rightly considers it to be one of the great wonders of the American state, as well as our greatest poverty reduction program. He credits Social Security with helping invent the very notion of old age as a coherent stage of life. He deplores right-wing efforts to privatize Social Security in the name of Mammon, as well as attempts to privatize its imperfect but indispensable successor programs, Medicare and Medicaid, signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965. As John Updike put it, pushing back against the historian Amadeus Schloss's criticism of the New Deal, Government is ultimately a human transaction, and Roosevelt put a cheerful, defiant, caring face on government at a time when faith in democracy was ebbing through the Western world. Chappell tracks the multiple ways that women, people of color, and those with disabilities have found it harder to access benefits and to achieve a dignified retirement. He shines a spotlight on figures you're left wanting to learn more about. These include Jacqueline Jackson, the pioneering black sociologist, and Maggie Kuhn, the charismatic founder of the advocacy group The Gray Panthers. Kuhn appeared more than once on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. On YouTube, you can find clips of her appearance with Candace Bergen on an early episode of Saturday Night Live. Chappell attends to the changing language of age, how stigmatizing terms like senior citizen and impotence morphed into older people and ED. We will all pass away amid euphemism. In her most recent collection of stories, Anne Beattie expressed surprise that the cosmetic industry has yet come up with an ameliorating substitute for the word wrinkles. The growth of AARP is accounted for with its magazine, its discount clubs, and its travel programs. It is a largely benign and sunny organization that focuses politically, when it does at all, on age discrimination. Chappell spends several chapters teasing out the meaning of the sitcom The Golden Girls, about four older women living together in Miami that ran on NBC from 1985 to 1992. It's a show I didn't watch, I'm sorry to admit, because I was young then and I did not want to see a show about the old. Chappell makes me want to revisit The Golden Girls, but I wish his book had taken us closer to the present day. I would have liked to see him unpack the content of more recent series, Grace and Frankie, The Kaminsky Method, Hacks. If Chappell's book has an argument, it's that the left has missed opportunities to strengthen and expand programs such as Social Security and Medicare. There has been no similarly ambitious legislation for a long time. Increasingly, the left is losing the intellectual battle as well. Happy and few are those who aren't worried about having enough money to see them through this life. Chappell traces the decline of pensions and the rise of saving plans such as 401ks and IRAs. He concurrently tracks the rise in anxiety. Looking at one's savings too often can encourage dementia in almost anybody. William Faulkner felt washed up at 47. He wrote in a 1944 letter to Malcolm Cowley that he felt like a mare that had dropped, in the form of novels, too many foals. Faulkner already had two grandchildren. Maybe he'd have felt younger if he'd done as Hunter S. Thompson did and ordered them to call him Ace. The reviewer, Dwight Garner, is a book critic for the New York Times, writing about fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and the book world writ large. How to Sleep at Night by Elizabeth Harris. This book was reviewed by Linda Holmes. The witty opening of Elizabeth Harris's How to Sleep at Night finds Ethan Keller confessing something terrible to his husband, Gabe. He wants to run for Congress. Ethan is a Republican, but Gabe is a Democrat, and Ethan says he won't run if Gabe says no. Wanting to support his husband's dreams and fearing the resentment a refusal could bring, Gabe agrees. While Gabe and Ethan's political rift is the crux of the book, Harris cools the stakes to a conflict between center-left and center-right. Gabe may be a Democrat, but he's scornful of people he considers too far to the left, calling them nuts. In fact, he has tried to bond with Ethan by poking fun at a clownish devotion to 16-letter acronyms and an eagerness to be offended by everything. Ethan explains his beliefs to their 5-year-old daughter privately by saying that Republicans believe change should happen carefully and people should make the decision about their own lives. He uses more provocative woke mob rhetoric in public, but Harris, a New York Times staff writer who covers book publishing, presents that as a performance that may or may not represent his convictions. Neither husband identifies with what he considers the extremes of his party, although both know their very existence as a gay married couple with a child has political significance. More important than their divergent beliefs is Gabe and Ethan's shared attitude about those beliefs, which is that they can be set aside when they don't affect you directly. Gabe, a high school history teacher, can grit his teeth about Ethan's growing notoriety until a couple of his students, both gay and one undocumented, start to trust him less in favor of a teacher he can't stand. And what provokes Gabe's discomfort most of all is the way people talk on the internet about him and his marriage. Ethan treats his politics primarily as a vehicle for ambition. Gabe treats his as self-definition. The story seems headed for a confrontation between the two about how people should be treated and how the abstract idea of politics intersects with that question, but the confrontation never arrives. Over and over, when they approach the disagreements that seem too serious to ignore, they walk away, go to bed, or change the subject. This forestalling of what feels like inevitable and even necessary fractures can be frustrating and repetitive. But perhaps that's the point. To make a relationship like this work, you will, over and over, have the same fight that goes nowhere. The other strand of the novel follows Ethan's sister, Kate, a print reporter who reconnects with an old love, Nicole, a stay-at-home mom who's grown bored with her wealthy, conservative husband. Kate is discombobulated by Nicole's return and challenged by the thorny ethics of having her newspaper cover her brother's campaign. Kate and Nicole's relationship is much more focused on the personal and less on the public, and it's a thoughtful tale of people reconnecting in middle age with both the benefit and the baggage of long experience. And again, Kate's story suggests that these are people for whom personal loyalty is primary. Everything else is negotiable. Harris's lively writing and a fast-moving narrative accompany what's ultimately a bleak view of comfort in difficult times. The way to sleep at night, these characters find, is to secure your own future and make peace in your relationships, and then to think about what's happening to the rest of the world as little as possible. As Kate muses at one point, what's Gabe supposed to do? Does he blow up a pretty excellent daily life for something that feels abstract? I don't think most people would. You can sleep at night, in other words, through just about anything, if you don't have to sleep alone. The reviewer, Linda Holmes, is a correspondent at NPR. Her latest novel, Back After This, will be published in February. Play World by Adam Ross. This book was reviewed by Alexandra Jacobs. Before adulting, there were grown-ups, a word even more squiggly if they think about it, and one that in Adam Ross's new novel, Play World, takes on monstrous dimensions. As quite a few novels have done in recent years, Playworld takes readers back to New York City during the waning, gentle but grayish days of the Carter administration, and watches through adolescent male eyes as America flips over to lurid Reagan technicolor. "There you go again," the winning candidate famously told the loser during their second debate, as if it were off the cuff, thinks the protagonist of Playworld, the poignantly named Griffin Hurt. Symbol of urban protection, conjoined with the consequence of its failures. I knew a canned line when I heard one. That's because Griffin is, like Reagan, an actor. Gifted but conflicted, he has done commercials for Oscar Mayer Bologna and Lipton Cup of Soup and been cast in a movie with Jill Clayburgh and Shelley Duvall. He puts on a cape to play Peter Proton in a popular Saturday morning TV series, a scientific spoof called The Nuclear Family. Before we fought bad guys, we'd summon our powers by yelling split up. And his wages go towards the tuition for his fancy Upper West Side private school. Financially unstable, Griffin's own nuclear family is also threatening to split up. His father, born Sheldon Hertzberg, is a probable philanderer and a bit of a sad sack. A less successful actor who brags about his voiceover work for movies like Star Wars and Superman, and about the free checking and savings accounts he receives from the bank where he's a spokesman. Griffin's mother, Lily, is a former professional dancer who now teaches ballet and Pilates, and there's an oft-swatted-away younger brother, Oren. Following an apartment fire when Griffin was six, for which he feels horribly responsible, everyone sees the same psychologist, who also happens to be a family friend. Boundaries are not exactly abounding. It's a time of squeegee men, prank calls, and missing minors on milk cartons. Benign neglect is the norm. So is malignant attention. There are two outright predators in Play World. One of them is another family friend, the unhappily married Naomi Shaw, who at the psychologist's 40th wedding anniversary party takes an interest in Griffin that turns quickly, shockingly carnal, leading to a series of encounters in her Mercedes and elsewhere. She is 36, he is 14, and Mary Kay Letourneau has not yet made national news. The other is the wrestling coach at Griffin School, who alternates humiliating weigh-ins with sweaty private practice sessions in the gym or at his apartment. There's a gift of knee pads which Griffin keeps in his locker, along with Hermes ties from Naomi. Aspiring to be a comic book artist, Griffin escapes into an elaborate Dungeons & Dragons campaign, mapping a mythical Griffin world that resembles his city and its environs, and fantasizes about having a girlfriend his own age, though with Naomi's antish capacity to listen. It's not the play that's the thing in Play World, a gorgeous cat's cradle of a book that sometimes unravels into shaggy dog stories, but the lines in every sense of the word. The marketing taglines that bear the same force and resonance as elders' aphorisms. 10-10 wins, American Express, Calgon. The lines between juveniles and adults blurring and being crossed. And Ross's own refined lines, his powers of observation, an ironclad resistance to cliché, yielding perfect descriptions again and again. A crowd of Nightingale Bamford girls makes a sound between laughter and slaughter, as if the school itself were shouting. Central Park is that mood ring in the middle of Manhattan. By the grace of Ross's language, even a seasick sailor's trail of vomit descending off a warship into the ocean takes on, I swear it, a certain crystalline beauty. The title conjures so much. The theater's world of the play, Shell is cast in a big disaster of a musical, Griffin will flirt with Shakespeare. The imaginary realms of the child, the symbiotic escapes of the grown-up, and the scheme of a novel itself in which realistic characters, Ross has said the story is semi-autobiographical, can at whim be twisted and placed into ridiculous positions. During one domestic dispute, part of someone's pinky gets severed by a door jam, bounces into a koi pond, and is quickly devoured by a carp. A letter opener goes right through another character's palm. But Ross, who published the complex and dastardly novel Mr. Peanut in 2010, and a book of short stories soon after, then took on the editorship of the Suwanee Review, delaying this project, keeps such darkly slapstick moments to a minimum. The swirling vapors of Holden Caulfield are present in Play World for sure, but also Lolita, Willy Loman, and Garp. The novel is detailed, digressive, densely populated, dull at times, as life is, and capable of tracking the most minute shifts in emotional weather. It is the young and the restless edging into the bold and the beautiful. The reviewer, Alexandra Jacobs, reviews all kinds of books, but is often drawn to life writing, which includes biography, memoir, letters, essays, and some fiction. You Should Be So Lucky, by Kat Sebastian. This book was reviewed by Olivia Waite. Terrible things happen in romance. Death, betrayal, and tragedy are shockingly frequent before we reach the final pages. The central difference between romance and tragedy is that tragedy ends after the worst thing happens, but romance perseveres. My favorite romance of the year, You Should Be So Lucky, is this theory made manifest. A widowed reporter and a failing baseball player find solace together after staggering losses. This story is the gentlest kind of gallows humor, the pages overflow with that cathartic, bittersweet feeling you get when you're telling someone about the worst day of your life, and you're both laughing because the list of catastrophes just keeps going. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.